Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. And I have to say, this morning I had to get up really early because I'm connecting with a guest who you're about to hear, Ryan Musgrave Evans in Australia. There is 11 hours of time difference between the two of us, so I'm up really early in the morning. And this is the time, you know, I remember this from all the years I did morning drive breakfast radio in London and other places. Often you get the best of the weather. Beautiful crystal blue morning here, and for November, that's got to be a bit of a bonus. Thank you very much for all of your emails. In particular, Richard, thank you very much for sending me the pictures of what appear to be a ghost in Edinburgh, in a very haunted location there. Very impressive pictures. I think you should get an image analyst maybe to look at those, because they are pretty damn fascinating. And Gina in California, who got in touch today as I record these words. Gina, thank you very much for the nice things that you said. I'm really pleased that you've been following the shows, and I'm really pleased that you like them. Thank you very much for reaching out to me, Gina. If you want to get in touch with me, please go to my website, theunexplained.tv. Follow the link and you can send me an email from there. Now, we are going to tell you a story that some people may find unlikely. They may find it controversial. But, you know, we don't shy away from those things here. Ryan Musgrave Evans, experiencer and researcher in Australia, is on to us. That's explaining the 11-hour time difference here. He's written a book called The Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. What are they? You're going to find out in this hour. Now, you know, obviously, I know there are people who are sceptical about stuff. So if it's the kind of thing that you might be sceptical about, it might make you angry or whatever, then please tune out now. Don't listen. But I think Ryan Musgrave Evans tells a fascinating story. It's a story that I can't say did or did not occur, but I think it's well worth hearing and well worth taking on board. So it's Ryan Musgrave Evans talking about his book, his research, and his life on this edition. And I think, personally, you will find it interesting, but you let me know. Thank you very much to Adam, my webmaster, for his hard work on the website and getting the shows out to you. I'm looking ahead to 2022 and developing the show further. And by the time we get to 2022, I will have been doing this online for 17 years of my life, which has gone, there's my finger snapping, in the snap of that finger. It's just amazing. And I can only do it with your support, knowing that you are there. And thank you very much for being there for me through some very, very difficult times, especially this last 18 months, nearly 2 years now, which I would never, ever want to go through again. And I guess that goes for pretty much all of us, doesn't it? All right, let's get to Australia now and speak with the guest, Ryan Musgrave Evans, about crypto-terrestrials. Ryan, thank you very much for coming on my show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Howard. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, listen, there is an enormous, I've been explaining to my listener here, an enormous time gulf between the two of us, so it's your evening time and my early morning time. But between us, you know, I think we've got a pretty good average going. Talk to me then, Ryan, about you. You know, what do you do? Where did your interest in this kind of stuff come from? Let's get a picture of the person we're speaking with.
Right, yeah, well, I'm 42 years old. I'm an Australian. I'm from the state of Victoria, from the Mornington Peninsula, which is south of Melbourne. And I've lived all my life in Victoria, lived up in the Dandenong Ranges there, east of Melbourne at one stage. I've been a nurseryman, worked on wholesale tree farms. I've been a primary school teacher for a few years there, a relief teacher or a substitute. And they're probably the two main occupations I've had, in my adult life. And as for, an interest in the paranormal and particularly in ufology, well, that was given rise to by a whole slew of interesting events and, phenomena over my life. Particularly when I was a kid, it was less inclined to be interpretable as ET UFO related, although as I've come to be older, I'm starting now to appreciate that there's the connection between the two. There's a common, like a substratum that runs along both of those different kinds of normally what would be considered different areas of paranormal research. But when I was a kid, had a fair few paranormal experiences happening, fairly sporadically, not as many as I'd have now, but of the nature of what I interpreted as perhaps being fairies or elves, witnessing a being behind a tree once, which is a major life-changing event for me when I would have been about to turn 5 years old. Saw a dark creature behind a tree with huge eyes, long fingers reaching around the tree.
And you were 5 years of age and on your own, and you witnessed this thing. What did you do?
Well, I wasn't actually on my own. My family, we would go down to the local golf course. It was this annual thing about a week before Christmas. And there was a pine tree wood, like a American pine tree, Pinus radiata. A pine tree wood right along the edge of the golf course. And we used to lop off a limb and drag it home as a Christmas tree. And every year we did this, and we'd like stick it in a bucket with a bit of dirt and pretend it was a tree, but it'd just be a large branch. But this particular year, when my siblings were off in the trees looking for a suitable branch, my mother was standing there beside me with my younger brother on her hip. I saw this being, this creature, a dark look to it. Its skin was bizarre in that it looked like it was taking on the shape and texture of the bark of the tree. Long fingers peeking out from behind the tree with a triangular shaped face, big dark eyes, went in behind the tree, stuck its head out the other side again. I was saying to my mother, "You see that? What's that?" And she was saying, "Oh, that's your brother, that's your sister." And I could see them off in the distance further. And so she couldn't actually see this thing. And then my siblings all ran forward with the tree, ran straight past it, couldn't see it either. But what that did was that sort of ignited an interest in me for paranormal interest, but particularly in elves and fairies and tree spirits and things like that. So that was the way I had interpreted that. I decided I've seen one. I know this stuff's real now. I'm going to start researching it. So then through my teens, I really got interested in Celtic folklore, Gaelic fairy faith. In my late teens, I started learning Gaelic, Irish and Scottish Gaelic, and I've been learning that for the rest of my life. And I used to teach that at one stage as well, private tutelage, but really, really got heavily interested in that side of things.
Well, let's just jump in there. When you were 5 years of age, you had this moment that changed your life. Nobody else experienced it. Now, I've got to say that when I was 5 years of age, a lot of it I can barely remember. But, you know, sometimes for me as a little kid, the dividing line between stuff I'd seen on television and things that I was experiencing was sometimes a little fine. Are you sure that aged five you were experiencing something that was real because nobody else saw it?
Well, I mean, a person can't be 100% sure of anything, I suppose, but I am 99.9% sure. I used to say to my siblings that I'd seen this thing, and they didn't really believe me. I remember the exact year that it happened because there was another event at the same time happening simultaneously where my sister cut the side of her face on a twig, and so she remembered the year very well, and so we worked out what year it would have been. Mm-hmm. But and my age at the time. But okay, I can appreciate that it can be difficult to remember things early on. This event was stamped onto my consciousness very, very vividly. Since then, various times I've had interactions with beings that look the same, but these are suits that they wear, which I've come to appreciate and understand, a kind of a cloaking suit, a dark suit. At night, its eyes can glow red. So since I've seen them again, out in our yard, up in a nearby state park when I've been out running, and also coming into our house in interactions that are sometimes hypnotic. They feel a bit mesmerized, not necessarily completely and totally lucid all the time. Some experiences are more lucid than others.
You said they feel mesmerized. Are they mesmerizing you, or do they look mesmerized themselves?
Oh, well, they use mesmerization on you. So yes, to mesmerize me, to use, they have a facility for mesmerizing you, which is by way of technology, though. These particular, sort of getting way ahead, I suppose, at the moment, or jumping way into the nature of these particular beings. But I've been having more experiences of late, perhaps. When we first moved back down here, my wife and I, after being away, we moved back down to near where I'd grown up. And the experiences then started becoming much, much more intense, more frequent, where I would wake up in the middle of the night and there'd be shapes moving around the house. There would be sometimes more sort of typical ET-related abduction kinds of experiences where I'd wake up and there'd be some kind of medical procedure occurring.
So they were doing experiments on you?
Yeah, so implants, really. Some of these things are sort of like the very sort of typical ET-related lore of today. And this was this about 80 years or so, I had the first experience when I'd moved back down towards where I'd grown up. First experience that was more sort of ET-related, and that's where it sort of hit me that these earlier episodes and events in my life were perhaps interpretable as being related to ET lore and more recent, well, the glasses that we, the spectacles we look at the phenomena through today are through the eyes of technology and sophisticated technology and less through the spectacles of, say, interpreting it as being more esoteric or metaphysical or spiritual or something like that that people would have done once in earlier time. But, and my earlier experiences were for sure more alike to those that were described in centuries past, say in the Celtic fairy faith, and also throughout the world where they have societal humanoid beings living on the fringes of our world, unseen, occasionally impinging on our world. But suddenly about 8 or so years ago, I started seeing these same beings through more of the lenses that they're interpreted through today and seen through today as perhaps ET or UFO related, because suddenly there was this notion of sophisticated technology coming into play rather than magic. If you'd like, I tell you the very first experience that I had that started to be, to take on more of this tinge or color of an ET UFO slant.
Before we do that, can I just ask you this question? I think it's important.
Yeah.
When you're a kid and you're having these experiences, presumably you were talking to your parents and your siblings about it, explaining to them what was happening to you but not happening to them. And now, of course, you're married, so you have a wife who is going through this with you. What do people around you say about this? What do they think?
My wife was the first person that I told about it, and that was probably about 6 or so years ago. So I've been having some quite intense experiences and frequent experiences before, for a couple of years before I told her. At first she was incredulous, as you can imagine, but then she decided after a little while maybe there was something to it. Nowadays she's more inclined to believe that what I'm saying may have something to it, because also I've written this book of mine that is for the most part an exploration into the presence of these beings through a particular race, the race that I've seen and know through history, from the Celtic fairy faith of old, through over the centuries into the modern UFO era that starts usually people say in 1947 with the Roswell incident and whatnot. Is usually the divider there from the old to the new. But she has looked at the information that I've gathered as I've built what I've called a crypto-terrestrial profile, looking for traits and characteristics, habitation, language.
Habitation is interesting. So have you found signs of where they live?
Well, yes. Yes, well, not I have not ventured out and in an archaeological kind of way excavated anything and found physical, tangible signs in that sense. But I have been taken down in under the ground. So they have underground habitations. And this is a repeated element through folklore of old times with elves and fairies, say, and then today as well in ET-related folklore, people often talk about these underground facilities and dwellings as being places where ETs reside under our mountains, etc.
And you've been taken to these?
Yes, I have one under Bass Strait, actually, in the continental shelf under Bass Strait, and another in, I'm not sure if it was, by the look of the flora, when I came back out again, it was either somewhere in the mountainous regions, like the hill country, the high country of Victoria, or rather somewhere in Tasmania.
So was this happening, and I'm sorry to jump in here, just want to make it nice and clear for my listener. Was this happening when you were in a dreaming state, or were you actually awake and something led you to a place?
Awake. These were totally awake, yeah. Some of my experiences I have, as I said before, I do feel mesmerized or hypnotized or not quite with it, and my mind will cloud out over and it does feel more dreamlike, although I'm quite certain a lot of those aren't dream experiences, because I feel fairly accomplished at lucid dreaming and things like that. I've been doing that for a lot of my life. I tend to think that dreams have a certain of a different feel to them. But yeah, some of those experiences sort of I feel more hypnotized or more dreamlike. But some experiences are lucid to the point of waking life. Not right. Lucid dreams, but having been taken by people in craft, in like these kinds of tic-tac kind of craft, people would call them nowadays. Once upon a time, they would have been more likely called RV, recreational vehicle type craft, like in the case of Charles Hall, who wrote the Millennial Hospitality series of books. He claims to have been a weather observer at Nellis Air Force Base in the 60s to have regular and prolonged interactions with a group of beings he called Tall Whites that whistled and chirped and lived in the mountains there, floated around at dusk on the horizon as sort of will-o'-wisp looking things, going through his shack, stealing his things, moving things around, messing with his mind by doing mesmerization and hypnotic control.
And that's like the experiences that you had. I'm just wondering, when you were taken to the underground habitations and you were, as far as you know, conscious, were the beings, the creatures that were taking you there, presumably they were communicating with you, were they? Were they telling you why they were taking you there?
They don't tell me why. Not really. They don't. One time when they took me, they led me down a ramp to a place where there were already Homo sapiens sitting and talking, a group of people sitting at a table, arguing about different things. And one of them led me over to this table, and I sat down at it as well, and entered into discussing with the people sitting at the table that were already there. They were having arguments about different kinds of races. And I was saying, oh, you're conflating two different beings. And we were having this discussion and argument, really. And then it was time to leave. We all of a sudden felt that it was time to leave. We all rose together. And then we wandered up the ramp again. And I could see the beings in their suits, in these dark suits with the glowing red eyes, escorting us back up the ramp, back to the craft. And I was saying to the other people that were there with me, the other Homo sapiens, you see them though, don't you? You're acting like you actually don't see them. And they were becoming quite distressed at the idea that these Tall Whites, or Mudgener, they call themselves, were there with us. I didn't feel distressed by it at all. I just thought it was the most wondrous thing. And then we got on board the craft where there was a Homo sapiens guy taking us on board. The two pilots were Tall Whites. An interesting feature of the craft itself was that it just had seats from our buses. It was low-tech with segmented parts.
And it had bus seats.
And bus seats, and the pilot seats looked like maybe they were from our fighter craft. And so this is a repeated thing as well. Charles Hall spoke about this. He said when he saw inside some of their craft, there were ovens and showers and hammocks and different paraphernalia. He thought, he recognized as being straight off the shelves from their stores.
So did that make you think when you saw those things that were very familiar to you and rather low tech, that maybe what you were experiencing was something connected with us? You know, maybe they didn't come from 20 billion light years away.
Well, that's right. Yeah. And it gets quite complex actually, because from what I know about them, okay, so I'm calling them crypto-terrestrials. And in my book, I call them Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. Now, that title in itself kind of is a contradiction, really, because Orion, of course, is an extrasolar constellation that has no involvement with our galaxy, with our solar system, with our planet. But crypto-terrestrial was a term coined by Mac Tonies, a guy who passed away quite young, unfortunately, in 2009. He was only in his 30s at the time. But his own book, The Crypto-Terrestrials, A Meditation on Indigenous Humanoids and the Aliens Among Us, was published posthumously in 2010. And he had what he called the Crypto-Terrestrial Hypothesis, or CTH, he said, for brevity. And he floated it out there as an alternative to what he saw as the dogmatic extraterrestrial hypothesis, or ETH, that most people just presume a priori to be the best and most fitting hypothesis to answer who and what the beings are behind the ET phenomena, UFO, close encounter phenomena.
Okay, so that was his answer. And again, here I am doing it, I'm jumping in. And you chimed, obviously, with what he had to say. But did the beings who were with you when you were taken into a craft, were they communicating with you? You say part of some kind of mass abduction by the sounds of it. So were they talking to you? Were they saying, we've taken you, Ryan, for this reason, that's why you're here?
No, they don't specify. They have never really specified exactly why. They've said they've known me all my life. They sometimes compliment me in certain ways. Sometimes it's sort of in a patronizing kind of way, though. Like they call me clever monkey and things like that. They've called me needle in a haystack as well, sort of terms of endearment or something, but they can be sort of come across as being sort of patronizing as well. I think I am not 100% sure, but I think they may have identified in me that I am an efficient tool to assist them in some way in their long-going disclosure initiative that they're now implementing of their own.
That's interesting. So do you think that this all ties into what we're seeing in the news at the moment? The, you know, American space agency NASA, for example, taking an interest in UFOs for the first time, seemingly, and various other moves that are happening. You think it's all part of a plan?
I suspect it is. I think it is. I think it's probably something that's being initiated by them. And as I said, as crypto-terrestrials or indigenous humanoids, crypto-terrestrial is hidden earthlings. So, you know, Mac Tonies had said the beings, you know, it's a running theme through close encounter events and abduction events that they seem to be interested in our genetics. They even interbreed with us on occasion. They seem perhaps to be interested in some kind of hybridization program. And he said, well, if they are beings that have a separate evolutionary history unrelated to the Earth, then that doesn't make any sense. So that's why he suggested they were crypto-terrestrials. They were perhaps a sister race to us. Mm-hmm. And that is what they are, that are quite closely related. I'm not sure whether you'd say that they were another species or a subspecies.
So when we talk about creatures from outer space, and we have for decades, because that's the only way that sometimes we can rationalize the stuff that people are reporting, you're saying, Ryan, that we've got it all wrong, that what we're seeing, what we're experiencing is some kind of, you use the word substratum, but, you know, some kind of relation of ours.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And it gets quite complicated as well. So at one stage I said to the beings, and this was, I would have been in my teens. I said, you are too similar to us to be anything other than some kind of version of ourselves, maybe from our ancient past. And they had said to me, it's more complicated than that, right? And then years later, they had said to me, perhaps when I was, probably around, when I was around about 30 or maybe in my late 20s, I'm not quite sure, had said to me, we are you. We are your future. As I've tried to demonstrate in my book and also on my YouTube channel, I make some sort of vlogs, some videos and go through various cases and build on this sort of profile of characteristics demonstrated through cases throughout time, that they are, their origins lie in a distant future of ours or a potential future with failing genomic structures, with impoverished DNA. They have returned to a version of their ancient past, the earth that they had originally come from. This particular group had colonized an earth-like planet orbiting Al-Nalam, or Epsilon Orionis, the middle star of Orion's belt, which is why my book's Children of Orion. And that explains that apparent inconsistency or contradiction there, where I'm saying they're from Orion, but still somehow crypto-terrestrials. Well, they are crypto-terrestrials. That still fits MacTonie's hypothesis, because they were originally from here, or a version of here. So their DNA is very, very similar to ours.
So why did we're talking here at the moment because of things that are happening on this planet, of looking at, you know, maybe moving some of us to somewhere else like Mars. So you think that they were from here, went somewhere else, and now because their DNA is becoming depleted for whatever reason, they're coming back here to find their origins?
Yes, to find their origins, but their primary concern is their unraveling DNA, for want of a better way of putting it. They have been genetically engineering themselves for so long and deliberately altering themselves that they have caused a lot of issues in their genetic programming. They heal very slowly. They're susceptible to a lot of diseases. One of their particular problems is they deliberately focused on lengthening their lifespan. So longevity was very important to them, and they can live up to 700 or 800 years. But the issue is that a genome being a systemic, holistic thing, if you focus and deliberately make changes and think that you're quite clever and that you're going to particularize these changes perhaps just lengthening your lifespan, but isolating it to that. All of these unforeseen symptoms and side effects also come out of the mix. And for them, they've caused a lot of damage to their DNA through deliberate genetic tampering. And they could not fix it. And so they have come back to the source. So we are to them, and some people don't like me putting it this way, but we are... kind of like free-range archaic humans to them. So they have re-established themselves here, and they did it a couple of thousand years ago, or maybe even longer.
So they're going back to their roots to find something that they've lost. Why are they not? Why are they doing it in such a secretive, clandestine way by, you know, communicating with people like you? Do you think, Ryan? Why aren't they going to Washington, coming to London, you know, going to Canberra? To tell, you know, people who make decisions about us who they are and why they're here.
Well, they did do that in the 40s and 50s. They were doing that. They were going out of their way to present themselves to the powers that be, and signed treaties and were told not to present themselves. Were told by our betters not to not to present themselves, that there'd be too much of a problem, that it would destroy our economies, that it would cause panic. So they became clandestine again, covert, which they're very good at doing anyway. At different times through history, it would seem they've been less and more inclined to freely interact with us and be more openly present. Like, for instance, the fairy faith in medieval times, say throughout Europe, really, where there was this, a belief in fairyland all through, not just Celtic people, but the Germanic people and the Romance people and all, that they would, there was a much better understanding anyway, a much more sophisticated understanding those people had then about the nature of those beings than we do for the most part now, because I think they were more inclined to wander about, interact with us. You know, we considered them fairies or elves, not fairies in the sense of the modern pop culture understanding of a little lady with wings, or elves in the sense of Santa's helpers at the North Pole, but the older sense of these words, like Uishlin, Nahuishlin, the gentry, and the sheikh and the fairies, the Gaelic elves or fairies, tall, fair beings, subterranean dwelling, that would whistle or chirp, that would float around as luminous lights at dusk, behave like poltergeists, play tricks on people, interfere with people's minds, use what was called glamoury, like glamours on people, so to make them, lead them into false understandings about the nature of what they were seeing, or by deliberately interfering with their minds. So the description, say, of Nahuishlin, and the descriptions that the tall whites that Charles Hall gives in his Millennial Hospitality books that were first published in the early 2000s are identical, even down to the whistling, chirping language.
And how come they keep themselves? I mean, I think you gave me a clue of this. You said that sometimes they almost sort of erase people's memories or play with their minds. But, you know, how are they able to keep themselves so clandestine, so secret?
Well, they can cloak. These dark suits that they wear, when they're not cloaking, they're either black or dark grey. They can become intangible, so they can pass through solid objects. They can levitate. They can cloak to the point that they're completely invisible. Sometimes it's less efficient and more of a heat haze kind of look is still evident, sort of like in the, you know, made famous in the Predator movie franchise, like the old Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, where people say this kind of haze can still be kind of like a silhouette or outline of a figure moving around. People sometimes report seeing their suits sometimes are less effective in that way, but sometimes completely invisible. I'm not quite sure why. Sometimes they're more effective than at other times, whether it has something to do with some of their suits not being as effective as others, as sophisticated as others, or why, or sometimes perhaps deliberately allowing us to see aspects of their existence, because they have like, it's a long play for them. As well as their lifespan being considerably longer than ours, they also have advanced technologies that allow them to pilot reality in the sense of piloting a research project or piloting a TV show. They can see potential realities through technology that allows them to enact certain changes in reality now that will produce the desired result 10, 20, 50, 100, even 1,000 years or beyond into the future.
Okay, I don't quite understand that. You mean that they are manipulating our reality?
In the sense of whatever they do, just as all of us as beings present in this reality now, this space-time, whatever it is, this universe, this world, every time I make a decision to pick up a pen beside me now or put it down, by the nature of the systemic nature of reality, you know, people talk a lot of nowadays about the multiverse, about potential worlds, parallel worlds. If I pick up this pen and put it down now, what kind of effect is that going to cause? Like an infinite chain of causality that will mean I would think very little in the short term, but perhaps in the long term, it might mean that there's a hurricane on the other side of the earth in 10 years that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't have picked up the pen at exactly that point in time. Mm. You know, people talk about the butterfly effect systems thinking, systems science and understanding about the nature of reality. They have a very sophisticated understanding of that kind of thing. They have prophetic technologies, I suppose you'd call them. They can see potential realities and see what will happen if they act in certain ways now. Will it produce the desired result that they're aiming for further down the line?
So they're playing with our planet, you're saying? Okay, so they don't know the outcomes of various things. Sounds to me as if they have possible technologies that could make life a lot better for us. You know, it would be nice if they would use them to our benefit.
Well, I think that's the idea. I think their plan is, from what I can tell, that they would very much like to, because basically the biosphere is in trouble at the moment, the kinds of substances we're relying on, like the materials we're relying on to produce our energy, the fossil fuel industry, we're burning coal for electricity. Last time I checked, this wasn't a steampunk movie. I'm not quite sure why we're still using coal in that way to produce electricity, but basically we're stuck in that sense. And we can blame, you know, some people will blame, you know, big corporations wanting to make a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. Whatever the cause is at the moment, there's definitely a barrier to us understanding, producing and benefiting from clean alternatives that will be less of a drain and less of a problem to our planet.
But you're saying the creatures that you've had contact with, though,
have the
technology that could, you know, they could save us from, if bad things are going to happen to us, then it seems that they could save us from it. And it just seems a little incongruous to me. Why wouldn't they step in and do it?
Yeah, that's the end game for them. They do want that to happen. They want to introduce us to some of their new sustainable energies. But the problem is, I don't think they necessarily trust us. They don't really think that much of us as a race, in the sense that they don't think that perhaps you could say, psychological, emotional, maybe even spiritual level has evolved to the same kind of sophistication of our technologies. Basically we are like children in adults' bodies. We do not understand the implications and the long-term destruction that our technologies are causing on the Earth. They would like to bring to us safe technologies. We are destroying their world too now. They are back here and they are permanently here. They want our biosphere to be a healthy one. If they share their technologies with us, they have to make sure that we do not weaponize them. Basically, for them to share their technologies with us would mean they would have to take over our planet and make sure that we didn't really understand the processes of this technology, because we would be inclined to misuse and abuse it.
All right. I would have thought, but, you know, I don't know anything about them. They've never contacted me, that they could probably build in safeguards. But that's a whole other thought. Now, I've got to say this, because I have some very skeptical listeners who at this very moment will probably be writing emails to me about you. So to them, can you assure them that what you've been experiencing are not just vivid dreams through your life and you've interpreted them all as being real? Because some people, you must have heard this, some people who are going to be writing me those emails just aren't going to believe you. What would you say to them?
I'm not just plugging my book, but I am plugging my book. But I'll just that is what I wrote my book for, because I don't actually talk about my own experiences until the end of my book. My book is my attempt to be as objective as possible, which I admit is difficult as an experiencer of these things as well. But what I've done is try to be as detached as scientific as possible. What I've done is I've created what I call the CT profile or cryptoterrestrial profile, as I said before. So I take the reader by the hand from ancient times in the Celtic fairy faith, move them through to modern times and modern cases, moving through like the case of Antonio Villas-Boas in Brazil, where he met barking, chirping, pale beings, to Charles Hall's testimony, and then to Chris Bledsoe, a more recent of the Fayetteville incident in North Carolina, where he had a wondrous interaction with beings and still does till today. And what I demonstrate with the CT profile is I look for characteristics that are repeating through cases. So I take these characteristics, I add them to the profile, I use the profile to seek out other cases. So as I said before, you know, we have the Nahuishlan, the Gaelic fairies, that are a very close description, matching very, very closely the description of Charles Hall's tall whites from Nevada. I add all these points of tall, slender, fair beings, chirping language, mesmerization, hypnosis techniques, poltergeist-like activity associated with them, luminous suits, and then I look for other cases that may be similar, and I find other fair beings, barking language, chirping language. Charles Hall said barking language as well. And then if these new cases have extra added elements, the list is continues to be informed by these new cases as I move forward again and use the ever-expanding list to seek out other cases.
Sorry to jump in again, Ryan. Those cases that you quote here, and I'm sorry I'm interrupting you, and that's partly because of the digital delay, but also just because I want to make this clear. The cases that you talk about, obviously some of those people like Villas-Boas are no longer with us. I think he died quite some years ago because he was born in 1930 sometime. But, you know, some of the more current ones, have you made contact with any of these people to share your experiences? You know, people like Calvin Parker, Travis Walton, and the others that you've mentioned.
I have had an attempt to contact Charles Hall. I'm not quite sure now whether I've ever interacted with the man or was interacting with his wife, Marie, I think handles all of his emails and things like that. I have never had the opportunity to interact with Charles Hall on a one-on-one basis and talk to him about my experiences, no. Christopher Bledsoe Sr., he was the second person I ever told about my situation. Well, that was years ago now. And I've had a fair few discussions with him about this kind of thing. He said to me that he's friends with Charles Hall and he's talked to Charles Hall about the possibility that the race that they have, the two separate events in their lives are the same race, perhaps. So as for a couple of the other gentlemen you mentioned, I haven't tried contacting them. There have been a few different people I've talked to who are interested and supportive. Other people aren't overly interested.
For listening to you, what you need to find is somebody in a university there. You've got some great universities in Australia willing to look at your research, willing to listen to your experiences and maybe, you know, team up with you. Have you tried that? Would that be a good idea?
No, I have not tried that. So what would be the reason for doing that, in your opinion?
Well, further information, quantifiable proof, those sorts of things.
Quantifiable proof. Okay. I have actually tried to contact a couple of people, ufologists and UFO researchers in Australia about this, about my experiences, and they don't respond.
Okay. Why do you think that might be?
Well, I'm not quite sure. I think people are particularly skeptical of someone claiming to be a contactee or an experiencer that knows too much. I actually am inclined to agree with them in most contexts, where usually Most of the other experiences I have read about and believe are individuals that don't really understand what's happening to them for the most part and have a lot of questions and not many answers. I don't blame them if they're skeptical of me in that way. That might be partly the reason why they don't respond to me. Because a lot of the people that are claiming to be experiencers or abductees or contactees out there that seem to have this large understanding, a strong understanding of what's happening to them, and also, you know, histories and backstories for the beings that are contacting them and that kind of thing. I don't really necessarily believe those people, a lot of them, when I've been looking at it. So I'm quite skeptical of that kind of thing myself. But for the people that are skeptical, as I was saying before, if you have a look at my book, I think I haven't come across anyone yet who's read my book and everything that I've put in it. Mm-hmm. That was anywhere near as skeptical as they were before they read it. I'll put it that way. You can't really make a lot of these coincidences up.
I'm doing that again, jumping in here. I'm just trying to clarify a couple of things that have occurred, and they're going to get forgotten if I don't do it now. You say that you had some implant type procedures done. Or certainly some procedures done on you. Are there physical signs of those?
No, I don't think so. Well, I've never had them scanned or anything. But the first one that I remember having was where I woke up on, I was standing, all of a sudden I was conscious and it was night and I was standing on our porch. And I knelt down and started lining up drinking glasses and coins and went into this odd sort of obsessive compulsive kind of mind state. Felt very strange and thought, I'm not really supposed to be out here. This is bizarre. So I started to stand up, started to walk towards the door, began to levitate, went up over the roof of the porch, up into the sky, and then was suddenly in a bed with one of my legs pushed to the side slightly and the other one sticking out straight, with a woman with huge blue eyes and white hair, sitting on the bed next to me, projecting a feeling of calm. I felt incredibly calm. And there was this very tall individual with very long fingers that started feeling around inside my mouth, checking my teeth. He wandered around to the back of the bed, lifted my head slightly, and performed the most painful thing I have ever had in my life, much worse than feelings I've ever had where without anesthetic. Much worse than any tattoos I've ever had, on the back of my head where the hole where your backbone goes into your skull, where the vertebrae goes into your skull, just slightly to the left. Incredibly intense.
Sounds like a really difficult thing to have happen in such a sensitive place.
Yeah, but I felt fine about it. So this was sort of mental manipulation, making me feel fine despite the pain. But so then there was a scan. And then my vision, I could not see out of my eyes anymore, so that I was just having images of wilderness and forests and deserts and the ocean flicking across my eyes one after the other, like I was watching a projector, and my eyes weren't working anymore. I couldn't actually see the room or anything anymore that I was in. And also, this weird thing was happening as well, where in the background there was this constant sound that the only thing I can liken it to is like a spade being dragged across a concrete surface over and over again. And then later on I was thinking, I wonder if I was hearing my own breathing or if it was a machine, I'm not sure. But anyway, so after that happened, I said, what was that all about? And they said, transmitter. Okay, so they actually gave me an answer about that one. Another time that I had one put in the sole of my foot and then in the top of my head and then on my back, which I think was in a rib, they said for language and for running. And then I said to them, language, I said, well, I'm fairly keen on linguistics. And I also do a fair bit of running, like trail running. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? Has it got something to do with this? And the woman said, it's a gift. Stop going on about it. And then they took me home. Boom. So there's been a couple of times where they've sort of given me responses, albeit
fairly short strange, and sharp by the sounds of it.
Ambiguous kinds of sometimes like language and running, like what does that mean? And then as for there being any marks or anything like that, I haven't had. So the one on the back of my head, I never checked. I think a lot of their, well, what do they do? It heals incredibly quickly as well. They have no trouble healing us or healing animals, but they have a very hard time trying to heal their own bodies. And this is, as I mentioned before, to do with genetic problems.
Big question. Do you think that there is any connection between these experiences that you've had and what you've documented and the Australian phenomenon of Yowie? I mean, personally, I believe that Yowie exists. I've spoken to enough people who've experienced this creature in Australia that, you know, I think there is something there. And some people say that it has a very strange kind of psychic dimension to it. Do you think there is a connection?
There are connections. One of which is this is a theory of mine, but I think, as in the case of Skinwalker Ranch, famously, where there's cryptids, where there's like Bigfoot, giant canids that are previously thought to be extinct, like giant wolves, giant dogs with huge bushy tails and things like that, these kinds of sort of monstrous beings like Yowies are some kind of tool that the crypto-terrestrials use. They're not alive as well. They're kind of like a
hologram.
You know, like in the case of but physical, but substantial. Like in the Skinwalker Ranch case, famously the rancher there fired a high-powered rifle at the dire wolf, the giant wolf that was there that was killing his lamb, and parts of flesh were blown out the back of it. And it just didn't have a pain response and it wandered off. And then they tracked it and its footprints disappeared. Like it wandered off. It was gone, but its footprints just led into a riverbed or something and it was gone. When they looked at the flesh, it was decaying. Now, whether the flesh had begun to decay rapidly after leaving the animal or if the animal itself had been made of decayed flesh in some way, who knows? But in my opinion, at least some of these cryptids, these stranger cryptids like giant hominids or Bigfoot, Yowie type creatures, giant wolves and things like that, are actually a tool for intimidation, to repel us from areas where we're not welcome, as in the case of the Gormans at the Skinwalker Rancher case. They were not welcome there.
So they're like a guard dog.
They're like a guard dog, but without really being alive.
Wow.
Perhaps a bit like the undead. Annihilated at their whim as well.
That makes a lot of sense.
But also another element to the Yowie Bigfoot thing is that the Sierra sounds that were recorded in the Sierra Nevada mountains by Al Berry and Ron Moorhead in the early 70s, they're famous. A language spoken that sounds, to Western ears at least, like perhaps Japanese. Some people would say Korean. Almost sounds like it's been dubbed samurai chatter because it sounds like Japanese spoken in a kind of aggressive, masculine kind of way, like maybe you'd hear samurais speaking it, a deep, resonant kind of Japanese, intermixed with animal sounds, barking, chirping, howling, hooting. Now, this is definitely tall white language. Now, I've heard this myself. Charles Hall in his Millennial Hospitality books talks about these animal sounds, which are camouflage languages, so that their real language sounds like to us sort of like Japanese, and but their camouflage languages where they mimic wildlife from different parts of the world, dogs barking, horses whinnying, fox calls, coyotes, these sounds that were recorded by Ron Moorhead in the 70s are definitely tall whites. There's a famous case as well of a tall white experience, a Spanish man that was abducted in Spain in 1978, I believe it was, called the Soria abductions, S-O-R-I-A. He was invited on board a craft where there were these tall, fair beings who spoke to each other, who barked and whistled and spoke to each other in what he said sounded like cries of the martial arts of the Orient. That's how it was described. And he said that they threw the sounds up out of their diaphragm. He said it sort of sounded a bit like German for its guttural features, so maybe like Chinese for its monosyllabic features. Then afterwards, a ufologist who interviewed him played for him some world languages just to sort of get an idea of maybe what it sounded like. And Julio Fernandez settled on maybe, he said, Korean. Out of all of them, Korean. Now, I spoke to Ron Moorhead about this. I said to him, dude, I don't think this is Bigfoot or Sasquatch. This is tall whites, quite typical of the sounds they make. And he said to me, well, he didn't ever get to see them, so that's a possibility. He said all he knows is that they had very big feet. But of course, Ron Moorhead also, in concert with all of this, was subjected to sophisticated high technologies, UFOs, orbs, humming sounds coming from the mountain. Something that he said looked like a lightsaber without a handle, like a beam of light rolling across the surface of the ground, or just above the ground, like maybe scanning for something. And also tall whites have huge feet anyway, so that's no problem. Some experts considered these sound samples, they said whatever was making it was between 7 and 8 foot tall. Well, that's no issue as well, because tall whites can get up to 10 foot, depending if they're quite advanced in age. And also that their sounds are beyond the hearing of Homo sapiens, too high for us to hear, too low. Well, that's another aspect of tall white language that Charles Hall went into in detail, that they can twist and contort their vocal cords to produce sounds that we can't really hear, too high and too low. So the Sierra sounds are definitely tall whites, not Sasquatch. I get myself into a little bit of trouble there because with Sasquatch enthusiasts, they don't like me saying that, of course. I'm not suggesting that Sasquatch doesn't exist necessarily, but I'm very certain that that is not evidence for the existence of Sasquatch, rather very strong evidence for the existence of tall whites.
So, Ryan, at this stage, just as we're coming to the end of this then, what would be the takeaway message or point that you would want to leave my listener with? What would you want them to know?
That most paranormal activity in the world is attributable to one race, this race. Most ghost phenomena that we would consider to be maybe caused by the spirits of deceased people, so poltergeist activity, dark shapes, hearing voices in your house at night, footsteps on the stairs, boots across your roof, music being played, things shattering, sometimes even seeing people that you know or that used to be alive, that this is something, another trick that they have, where they can use a kind of like a doppelganger type thing. They're using a kind of glamoury. They can look like someone you know and trust to inspire a kind of, a trust from you and make sure that you don't react in an aggressive way and to ensure compliance, basically. But sometimes also they'll choose people from your memory that are no longer alive. So you might think that you've interacted with someone, you know, great Auntie Jan that used to like when you were a kid, who's been dead for 20 years. You saw her at the fridge last night and she told you, it's okay, honey, go back to bed. They use these kinds of tricks. So a lot of ghost activity in the world is caused by them. A lot of cryptid stuff that we've already mentioned. Most ET-related phenomena are attributable to this particular race as well, and they can be misinterpreted as lots of different things. They're being called reptilians a lot, I think, because when they're seen in their suits, these dark suits, they will have prosthetic claws on their hands when they're wearing their suits as well for defense. And long faces with sort of like a long nose appendage, which they use to amplify and project sound. Other kinds of ET races people think of, like mantis aliens, they're most likely responsible for the mantis alien myth as well, because they're medics that I've seen 8 to 9 foot tall with slouched shoulders because they get quite, their spines get quite deformed as they get older. Long fingers, huge eyes with black lenses in their eyes they wear when they're performing medical duties. They cover up their blue eyes or pink eyes. The older males actually have pink eyes. But they'll wear these, what I take to be smart lenses maybe, some kind of technology. Just look like a huge praying mantis, really, because they're so painfully thin and emaciated. So most ET races are these guys, most ghost phenomena, most cryptids. And, of course, we've also talked about elves and fairies and things like that. There's very little paranormal phenomena happening in the world today or in the past that is not a direct consequence of their presence here.
Okay,
or
so
it's
a one-stop shop explanation. You've written the book, The Children of Orion, Finding the Crypto-Terrestrials. What do you do next? How do you take this research on?
Well, I'm writing another one. Writing another book. I'm trying to get as many people as possible to understand the nature of these beings and to contact them. To contact them themselves as well, because I'd immensely like other people to join in the experience I'm having with a meaningful dialogue with them, which I don't think many people are having. Now, you mentioned before, you know, are there any, you know, researchers or scientists or people at universities that are interested in what I have to say? Well, there is a gentleman that I've been having a bit of interaction with recently, Trey Hudson, who wrote The Meadow Project, the South Skinwalker Ranch. It's a paranormal hotspot somewhere in America's South, which he hasn't divulged the exact place because he preferred to keep it free of people wandering onto it and looking for it. But his book, The Meadow Project, is just a smorgasbord of crypto-terrestrial phenomena that fit the CT profile perfectly. So I've been talking to him, and he sent me an email the other day saying that he's been back to the place and there's been more events happening that are conforming to the CT profile. So this is exciting stuff because he's doing scientific research with technology, with sophisticated toys of different kinds.
And it's exactly in the field that you're in. And listen, we're out of time now, Ryan, I'm afraid, but if any of my listeners, I always ask my guests this, if they want to ask you a question or share an experience with you maybe, or want clarification about something, do you have a place where they can contact you?
Yes. Up until recently, I was on Facebook, but I pulled the pin on that. So don't go looking for me there. But I have a YouTube channel, which is just my name, Ryan Musgrave Evans. And anyone who's interested in saying hello to me, in asking me a question, or if you have your own experience, if you go into the About section on my YouTube channel and you go down to Business Inquiries and Prove That You're Not a Robot, there's my email right there for anyone who's interested in saying g'day. You're very welcome. I'd very much like to hear from people. That'd be lovely.
That works for me. Thank you for spelling out what is a complicated story. But if it is so, then it would explain an awful lot of things. I wish you luck with the book, Ryan. Thank you for talking with me.
Good on you, mate. Thanks so much for having me.
Ryan Musgrave Evans. And don't forget, if you have any specific points that you want to raise about the book, about his research, things that he said, then please contact him. He told you in the conversation there how to do that, and I'm sure he would be very keen to hear from you. And I'm sure, equally, probably more so, that he would love to hear any stories that might be similar that you've experienced, because we know that there are people around the world who've had strange experiences, creatures that they've come into contact with, sometimes craft that they think that they have been transported to, experiences maybe they've shared with other people, maybe they haven't. I know that Ryan would love to hear from you if you've had experiences similar to his. More great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe. Please stay calm. And definitely please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.